is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, March 15, 2002. I'm Nell Abram. More than 20,000 people are arrested in India today in anticipation of renewed violence. Amnesty International issues a report chronicling the abuse of basic human rights of immigrants detained in the United States since September 11th. And two Texas students are on a hunger strike. But first, these news headlines.
These are headlines for Friday, March 15th. I'm Rob Manning. U.S. Special Envoy retired Marine General Anthony Zinni arrived in Israel and met with Prime Minister Ariel Sharon today in efforts to stem the violence in the region. As a show of good faith, Sharon withdrew from several West Bank towns, but he's kept much of the armed forces within striking distance. According to Peretz Kedron in Jerusalem, the partial withdrawal falls well short of what's being asked.
Oh, very definitely a partial withdrawal, which was carried out as a gesture to the U.S. Special Envoy Zinni, who has been having talks all day, and presumably the Israeli authorities wanted to show that there's willingness to meet him halfway. But the tanks and the troops are still there on the outskirts. The cities are encircled. The inhabitants aren't free to come and go. And in some places, the Israeli troops are still at strategic points inside the cities. So there's definitely no response to the Palestinian demand for a withdrawal from all the Palestinian areas. The Israeli withdrawal falls far short of that.
That was Free Speech Radio news reporter Peretz Kedron in Jerusalem. The Democratic majority on the Senate Judiciary Committee late yesterday rejected the nomination of conservative Judge Charles Pickering of Mississippi. From Washington, D.C., Ellen Ratner reports.
President Bush's first defeat on a judicial nomination came on a party-line vote, with all 10 committee Democrats voting against Judge Pickering. Republicans, including the president himself, have repeatedly accused Democrats of creating a vacancy crisis in the federal courts, while Democrats have levied charges that the Republicans are trying to stack the courts with the most conservative nominees. Committee Democrats repeatedly assailed Pickering's record on civil rights as a federal court judge. Democrat Chuck Schumer said that Pickering did not meet any of his standards for a circuit court nominee.
I have a simple standard for judicial nominees. I look for three things: excellence, moderation, and diversity. Unfortunately, Judge Pickering falls short on all three counts.
Democrats used the Pickering nomination to fire a warning shot at President Bush regarding court nominees they consider extremely conservative. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Ellen Rand.
President Bush wants to push his tough-on-terrorism approach into South America by loosening restrictions on aid to Colombia. Gareth Schweitzer reports from Washington, D.C.
The Bush administration favors supporting what it calls counterterrorism in Colombia and has placed Colombian rebel groups on its list of global terrorist organizations. Previous aid to Colombia was limited to counter-narcotics efforts and came with strings attached, such as human rights standards for the Colombian military and a limit on U.S. military personnel in the country. President Bush must now decide whether to ask Congress to remove only some aid restrictions or to also remove human rights standards from aid packages. Joanne Mariner of Human Rights Watch believes that that would be devastating for human rights in Colombia.
One of the most important aspects of its poor human rights record is its long history of links to violent paramilitary groups. Right now, the human rights conditions, you know, attack that. They try to put pressure on the Colombian military to cut those links. And we think that's absolutely crucial.
Included on the list of terrorist organizations is the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, or FARC. The Colombian government broke off 3 years of peace talks with the Marxist rebel group last month. In Washington, D.C., for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Gareth Schweitzer.
The 15 members of the European Union are meeting in Barcelona, Spain this weekend to discuss liberalizing trade in Europe, but they won't be alone. Thousands of police as well as NATO fighter jets are in the area, ostensibly to defend the meetings against terrorist attack. But they're also keeping away labor, environment, and human rights groups. Maria Carrion reports from Madrid.
Yesterday, over 100,000 trade unionists and others from all over the EU marched against what they call the ultra-liberal axis, composed of José María Aznar of Spain, Silvio Berlusconi of Italy, and Tony Blair of Britain. The three are leading an effort to deregulate the energy market in Europe and create a more flexible job market in order to become more competitive. Unions say that translates into less job security and lower pay. Opposing that effort are France and Germany, who say they will fight against policies that endanger labor safeguards. As President of Spain and temporary President of the EU, the right-wing AFNAD has lashed out against those taking part in the mobilizations and has suspended the Schengen Accords, which allow the free movement of people across EU borders. Thousands, mostly undocumented workers, have been turned away. The main march against the proposed economic changes is to take place tomorrow. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Maria Carrion in Madrid.
Today, the U.S. Navy notified the Puerto Rican government it plans to resume bombing exercises on the island of Vieques for 20 days starting April 1st. Civil disobedience is planned. This is Rob Manning for Free Speech Radio News.
Security agencies across India are on high alert to preempt any violence there. Today is the deadline given by Hindu extremists for beginning construction of a temple on the Ayodhya site, where a centuries-old mosque once stood. Sputnik Kalambi reports from Bombay, India's commercial capital that still bears the scars of the bloodletting that followed the demolition of the Babri Mosque a decade ago.
Prime Minister Vajpayee assuring Parliament that the rule of law will be upheld, even as the Hindu extremist VHP or World Hindu Council ups the ante by demanding that Parliament legislate to hand over the disputed site for the construction of a temple. An uneasy calm prevailed this morning in Ayodhya, with the administration throwing a security blanket around it. Thousands of people have been arrested nationwide, more than 10,000 in Maharashtra alone. The state's capital, Bombay, was shaken by horrific Hindu-Muslim bloodletting in the wake of the Babri Mosque's destruction 10 years ago. And peace groups are out in force to prevent a replay of the violence, especially after the carnage in neighboring Gujarat. Up to 2,000 people, mostly Muslims, were killed by Hindu mobs after a train carrying Hindu activists from Ayodhya was attacked, killing over 50 people. The state's BJP chief minister said the ensuing violence was spontaneous Hindu reaction to the train massacre. Mariam Dhavle of the All India Women's Democratic Association is just back from Gujarat. The events there were clearly premeditated, she says.
The people who attacked were armed very well with acid bulbs, with guns and with talwar swords. Muslim majority areas were surrounded by around 20,000 people and attacked. The people who were leading were definitely the Vishwa Hindu Parishad and Bajrang Dal leaders, along with the ministers and the workers, corporators, elected members of the BJP government in Gujarat. Secondly, there were the police. The police was totally hand in glove. All this points out to tremendous planning.
There are no words to describe the barbarity of the violence unleashed on the state's Muslim minority, she adds. This was an enactment of Hitler's Germany in Gujarat.
One-day-old babies also have been thrown into the fire. Women have been raped and then cut to pieces and then burned. You find that children have been beaten so badly, some of them who have remained alive are probably so shocked that their pained faces are just like stone. They do not know what to say, how to react. It is just miserable, and there is no treatment. Can you imagine their suffering?
Labor unions were also out in force on the eve of the Hindu extremist ultimatum. Dozens of unions came together in Delhi and Bombay to demand a halt to privatization and the withdrawal of proposed anti-working class changes to current labor laws. The Ayodhya issue, they say, is a red herring to divert public attention from the real issues.
The people are concerned for jobs, they're concerned for their houses. The slums are being demolished all over. In the countryside, the agriculture is being destroyed. People are being thrown off their land. People are religious, but they are not communal.
And adds Vivek Montero of the Center of Indian Trade Unions, CITU, the rally was as much against the government's communal policies as against its economic program.
We are together and we will remain together. We will not fight in the name of religion. And we took the march through the very areas where the communal forces are active. So we hope that on the strength of workers' unity, we will provide some countervailing pressures to the communal forces. And if we got more coverage in the media, would not be at all difficult to defeat these communal forces.
But vigilance remains the watchword. Secular forces have to stand up and be counted, says Mariam Tavle.
Definitely not the end. And the secular forces in the country have now to really buck up, put up their sleeves and get out onto the roads to say that they are not going to allow this in India. That is the need of the hour.
Sputnik Kilambi in Bombay for Free Speech Radio News.
Amnesty International issued a report saying a significant number of people detained in the United States since September 11 continued to be deprived of some basic human rights. Free Speech Radio News spoke with spokesperson Angela Wright, who says that many appear to have been detained arbitrarily.
Well, most of the people, as I'm sure you know, because it's already been reported in the few figures that the government has been given out, have been detained on immigration violations. According to lawyers and cases that we've looked at, in many of those cases, they're routine violations for which people would normally be released on bond or quickly deported. But many of those people have been held in detention without knowing why they're detained, and in many cases without effective access to lawyers. Some of them have been held beyond the dates posted for voluntary departure or deportation orders. And it's really a basic right, a fundamental right under international law, that people must be informed of the reasons for detention, and they must have the opportunity to contact lawyers and families. And in many of these cases, because of the secrecy surrounding the detentions, families have not been able to find out where people are being held. All these things violate international standards, and probably US law as well. We're also concerned about the conditions, the very harsh conditions under which many of these people have been held. They're not criminal detainees, but many of them are held in punitive conditions in jails, and some of them have been shackled while appearing before judges, which is a total contravention of international standards.
Does the secrecy surrounding these detentions exacerbate the potential for abuse?
Yes, it clearly does. I mean, from the organizations that we've spoken to who've been trying to monitor these detentions, it's created a whole series of problems. Because of the secrecy around these cases are not appearing on court dockets, and organizations have not been given general access to the detention facilities where these people are being held. So it's taken months for people to find out who is actually being detained. I mean, even now, there are no firm figures on who's detained. You know, there are some people who still don't have lawyers.
The Amnesty International report detailed the story of Rabid Haddad, a Lebanese national who's been confined since December 14th. Tell us about his case.
He may not any longer be in solitary confinement, but at the time, up until the time we were doing our research, he'd been held continuously in cellular confinement, reportedly with only 15 minutes a week, visits or telephone calls with his family. And there are a number of cases where people are held in very similar conditions. We're also concerned about the conditions in the Metropolitan Detention Center in New York City, where at least 40 people are held in cellular confinement.
Has Amnesty International been able to visit this facility?
No, we requested access to the center in New York, and that was denied, even though immigration detention standards do actually state that facilities housing INS detainees, immigration detainees, should allow access to outside organizations, including NGOs. We know that attorneys have not been allowed into the security housing unit. I believe that journalists who've made requests have also been denied access. And we certainly feel that the physical conditions in these kind of units should be open to some kind of public scrutiny.
That's Amnesty International spokesperson Angela Wright joining us from London. In Washington this week, the venerable Organization of American States building is draped in brightly colored hand-knit woolens. 50 indigenous leaders from all over the Western Hemisphere have broken down the old boy diplomatic network and taken a seat at the table with the greater body of American nations. The states and the Indians say they're one step closer to completing a Native People's Declaration of Human Rights. Joshua Chaffin reports from Washington.
Nosotros consideramos que también se debe enfocar la parte espiritual. Muchas de las prácticas tradicionales de medicina tradicional.
In Spanish, French, English, Portuguese, and myriad Indian languages, delegates from nearly every country in the Western Hemisphere engage in an often heated debate over the wording of the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. The Indians hope that document will give them leverage to assert their rights on the world stage. David Rothschild helped raise the money to get everybody to D.C. on behalf of a group called Amazon Alliance.
Many of them came from places deep in the Amazon. They had to take a boat ride, followed by a bus, followed by a plane, followed by another plane, followed by another plane. We had people arrive with huge sacks of clothes on their back, obviously walking a long ways. People in all different parts of and areas of the countryside had heard about this process and want to be part of it.
After more than 100 years, the Organization of American States has for the first time opened up to the participation of indigenous leaders who are elected representatives of their own peoples. The Indians have come a long way since colonial times when they were massacred in wholesale fashion, but even in the modern era, their relationship with the states they live in has been contentious. Across the hemisphere, states have refused to recognize indigenous leaders because they don't want to exempt native peoples from their nation's laws.
I remember some state representative was saying that, why are you going to touch the ants' nest? How are you going to put it back in their nest when they start, you know, talking about their rights? Can you imagine if you are trying to develop a woman's rights or black rights and you don't talk to black people or you don't talk to women? I mean, that would be terrible. But with the indigenous people, people still get away with that.
Armstrong Wiggins is a Mosquito Indian from Nicaragua and Latin American director for the Indian Law Resource Center. Wiggins says the election in Peru last year of President Alejandro Toledo, a former shoeshiner of ethnic Andean descent, opened a lot of doors to Indians. But he says governments still get nervous when Indians are at the table.
Some governments are basically, they're very paternalistic, they're very racist. Last year, I think that we begin to overcome. And the main problem last year I saw was the government of Chile, Argentina, Ecuador. This year, they have changed incredibly.
States in the OAS now concede that indigenous peoples have been deprived of their basic rights for centuries, but they're nervous about the idea of granting Indians legal self-determination. They look at the armed movement for political autonomy among Indians in Chiapas, Mexico, where the government has been forced to negotiate with people it considers Mexican citizens. Federico Villegas Beltran represents Argentina in the OAS. Argentina opposes the inclusion of self-determination in the Declaration of Indigenous Peoples' Rights.
Imagine countries with 60% of their population indigenous with a complete right of self-determination. What would it mean?
Argentina's indigenous peoples were nearly wiped out in the colonial era. Today they make up a little over 1% of the population.
Is it necessary to state self-determination with all the international law implication that that has in order to reach the declaration?
But with the legal right to self-determination, Indians say they can keep some control of their traditional homelands and the natural resources they contain. The Indians say they're sick of being the poorest of the world's poor, while states and multinational corporations profit from the natural wealth in and under their lands. Everyone involved in the declaration process says there's still a long way to go. But in the OAS, at least they have a place to call their national governments onto the mat. This week, a representative of one indigenous group was overheard to say, "We come here and meet officials from our own government, and we can talk. Back home, they won't even talk to us." Joshua Chaffin, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
A landmark scientific conference on Agent Orange that convened earlier this month in Hanoi brought together scientists and diplomats from the United States and Vietnam. The meeting ended with both countries agreeing on a framework for conducting joint research on the impact of Agent Orange and dioxin on human health and the environment. The talks were the first collaboration between the two countries to address what the U.S. ambassador to Vietnam called the last significant ghost of the war. More from Ngoc Nguyen.
Top environmental officials from the United States and Vietnam signed a memorandum of understanding this week after a four-day conference on the wartime chemical, which continues to contaminate tens of thousands of people 30 years after U.S. forces stopped spraying in 1972. Arnold Schechter, a public health researcher and professor at the University of Texas in Houston, who presented two studies on the impact of dioxin on health at the Hanoi conference, said the two countries readily agreed to collaborate on research but still disagree on the issue of compensation for wartime use of the herbicide.
Vietnamese side, the words American chemical warfare and compensations for Vietnamese victims of Agent Orange was frequently stated. On the American side, the representatives of the National Institute of Health, which sponsored the meeting, pointed out that the National Institutes of Health only does health research, and they do not do compensation or public health work.
Agent Orange contains a potent form of dioxin, a known carcinogen. It's estimated that U.S. forces dumped 20 million gallons of the defoliant to deny opposition fighters jungle cover. Schechter's study measured dioxin levels in hotspots, or areas heavily sprayed with Agent Orange. He found that dioxin levels were as high as 413 parts per trillion in Benoit, compared to a national average of 2 parts. The carcinogen has been blamed for causing birth defects, sterility, and a host of other health problems. The Vietnamese government reports 1 million people have been exposed to Agent Orange, resulting in tens of thousands of people born with birth defects. Hanoi has asked the U.S. government for redress. The U.S. government, which is also under pressure from American Vietnam veterans to compensate for wartime exposure to the defoliant, has denied that Agent Orange causes health problems. Vu Van Dung is an official with the Consulate General of Vietnam in San Francisco.
The Vietnamese people have been enduring heavy suffering and losses left by the U.S. war of aggression, settling the war aftermath, particularly those left by Agent Orange. Dioxin used by the U.S. Army during the Vietnam War was a pressing humanitarian issue that we hold that anyone with a conscience would support our argument that while promoting scientific studies, it is necessary at the same time to carry out relief activities to overcome the consequences.
The Vietnam government dropped their claim to compensation for wartime Agent Orange exposure when relations normalized between the two countries in 1995. The U.S. government continues to deny any clear causal link between Agent Orange and disease, but under pressure from American veterans groups, Washington has paid reparations to some soldiers exposed to the toxic defoliant. The Vietnam veterans have also received close to $180 million in compensation from Dow Chemicals and Monsanto, the manufacturers of Agent Orange. Sal Bloom of Arc Ecology, an organization that monitors the effects of war on the environment, says Agent Orange, like many weapons of war, has devastated both the people and the environment. He said the toxic effects of Agent Orange are carried down from generation to generation. The children of parents exposed to dioxin are born with birth defects. Then there's the deforestation, an irreversible altering of the country's ecology.
Does the victor then clean up? Does the victor make the vanquished clean up? And I think that has to be a much more subtle approach. I think that has to be seen as a mutual responsibility and some burden sharing on the part of both governments.
Bloom drew parallels between Agent Orange and weapons used in the U.S.'s current war on terrorism. He pointed to depleted uranium, high explosives, the constituents of plastics, napalm, and jelly gasoline. Bloom hopes the U.S. will learn from the health and environmental damage inflicted during its invasion of Vietnam. He said that if countries were forced to clean up that damage, they might think twice about which weapons they use. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Ngoc Nguyen.
While many students are spending their spring break on the beach, two Texas students are fasting to raise awareness of religious persecution in China. Practitioners of the Falun Gong are on day 4 of a hunger strike to bring attention to mass imprisonment of other followers. In Houston, Joe Gardner-Wesley.
Outside the Chinese consulate, on one of Houston's main boulevards, Danielle Wong and Kitty Wong joined fellow Falun Gong practitioners to publicize their four-day hunger strike. They say a March 5th order from Chinese President Jiang Zemin moved them to action.
Shortly before this event, Jiang has ordered Chinese Falun Gong practitioners to be shot on sight if they are caught putting up posters or banners. Many cities and provinces across China have now reportedly compiled, following the president's command, lists of specific Falun Gong practitioners to execute.
Activists say President Zhang gave the shoot-on-sight order after Falun Gong adherents in the Chinese city of Changchun broadcast a documentary over eight cable stations. The film purported to show how the government had staged a January 2001 incident in which seven people burned themselves to death. Hunger striker Danielle Wong.
There have been already several practitioners who have been shot and wounded as a result of this order.
Chinese consulate officials deny that Jiang made any such order. The Chinese government first banned the Falun Gong movement in July of 1999 after 10,000 members staged a nonviolent protest in Beijing surrounding the presidential palace in Tiananmen Square. Falun Gong activists say police torture has killed at least 375 followers. Danielle Wong, a civil engineering major at the University of Texas in Austin, counts her father among the thousands imprisoned under harsh conditions.
My father was arrested for practicing Falun Gong. He endured agonizing torture during detention and was subsequently sentenced to 16 years in prison, losing his freedom and all contact with his family. He committed no crime, yet he was subjected to this unimaginable ordeal.
Spokesman for the Chinese Consulate General in Houston, Mr. Zhuofan Yang, says constitutional protections for religious groups do not apply to the Falun Gong, since it is not a proper religion.
Many Americans believe it's a religion. It's not a religion. It's a cult, because it takes various kinds of religions, including Christianity, in Taoism, in Chinese traditional religion, and put them together to form the Falun Gong principle. So it's not a religion.
Government officials deny charges of torture. They say many Falun Gong members have committed suicide by burning themselves alive. Others are said to have committed brutal murders, jumped into wells, or refused medical treatment. Spokesman Yang says few are imprisoned.
It's just, you know, few people who are the organizers of the Falun Gong. They mastermind the plan against Chinese government. They organize the protest against the Chinese government. They make some money from attracting people to believe in Falun Gong. All these kind of people were sentenced, were put into a...
However, activists like hunger striker Danielle Wong say they're suffering from a massive wave of repression, and they intend to keep pressure on the Chinese government. Danielle says she's the third generation in her family of victims persecuted for vocalizing their beliefs.
My grandfather was tortured to death during the Cultural Revolution period. You know, his body was not even found after, you know, he was tortured to death. And then my father was imprisoned by the Chinese government because simply he practiced Falun Gong, and he was tortured and beaten severely in prison. Right now I'm losing all the contact with him and cannot see him, not even going back to, you know, my country. I cannot go back to my country now. They block my way.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Joe Gardner-Wesley reporting from Houston.
Free Speech Radio News was produced at Pacifica Station KPFA in Berkeley, California, and Community Radio WMNF in Tampa, Florida. I'm Nell Abram.